This episode was made possible by our incredible patrons. Their faithful support allows us to continue the work of amplifying the voices of spiritual abuse survivors. We are a small team composed of two families. We committed early on to not monetizing any of the stories, so we rely solely on the donations of our Patreon community to operate. If you value the work and are able to contribute, you can join for as little as $5 a month. Another way to support Bodies Behind the Bus is by following, rating, and reviewing the podcast. It only takes a moment, but has a tremendous impact on our reach. Thank you for daring to listen.
Today, we are honored to bring you Taylor's story. She will be sharing about her time on staff at her former church where she was the worship leader. Taylor's care for leading people in song, accompanied with her passion for ministry, are a reminder that women's voices and gifts are vital for the health of the church, and that it is a disservice to everyone when we devalue them. I'm Jonna Harris, and this is the Bodies Behind the Bus podcast.
I am all about blessed subtraction. There is a pile of dead bodies behind the Mars Hill bus. And by God's grace, it'll be a mountain by the time we're done. You either get on the bus or you get run over by the bus. Those are the options. But the bus ain't gonna stop. You either get on the bus or you get run over by the bus. Those are the options. But the bus ain't gonna stop.
All right. Welcome back, everyone, to the Bodies Behind the Bus podcast. We are excited to have Taylor on the podcast today. Taylor is going to be sharing about her time at her former church, which was in California. It is a part of the Reformed Church of America, and it's the egalitarian church. So, Taylor, welcome to the Bodies Behind the Bus podcast.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I kind of want to jump right in, being that this was an egalitarian church. If you can maybe explain a little bit more about how you came to work for this church and what your role was.
Yeah, I was 19 at the time that I applied for this church. And at the time, I was leading worship and organizing worship in a volunteer setting at various churches in the area in California that I was in, and just filling on the weekends when they needed a fill-in person. And a friend of mine who was a worship leader connected me with this church because they were in a transition period from their former worship leader moving on, and they needed people to fill in. So he passed my info on to them, and the leadership sent out an email to anyone who was going to be there in the next couple of weeks saying, hey, if you want to apply, here's the job description. And I read it and was like, I'm super underqualified and don't have many of the things they're looking for, like education and experience, but sent an email saying, hey, would you consider me anyways? And they did. And my age in the whole interview process was a big talking point because I was so young. But the pastor who was there that hired me, we'll call him Pastor B, he really believed strongly in women in leadership and young people in leadership. And when the elders at the time were just saying, oh, I don't think we can hire her because she's so young, he had a heart-to-heart with them and was like, that's your only reason. You got to give her a chance. So he's really the reason that I came to be in that position and why I'm even in ministry today.
So this was a predominantly older church at the time. That would be the demographic. Is that correct?
Yeah, this was a smaller, more traditional liturgical church. And the demographic was mostly white, mostly 65 plus boomer, silent generation folks. And it was also egalitarian, which was unique, but still it being such an older demographic and there not being many people in my age or stage of life there, I was a really unique choice to hire for that role.
What were you thinking as you went through this interview process and you knew this was an older church and they may have differing ideas from you on certain things? Like what was your thought process as you were going through this job interview about whether you wanted to take this role or not?
I was honestly really surprised that I got far at all in the interview process. I thought it would actually be more like good practice for me for someday. Because I thought this is something I want to do someday, like getting some good practice in for interviews will probably be good for me. And then I learned a little bit into the process that I was one of the final candidates and was like, oh, wow, this is serious. And then I started to really ask some questions like, hey, is me being a woman going to be a problem? And that was a very quick no, because they had female elders, they had women preach and lead in various capacities at the church. But really, the problem was going to be my age. So I asked the questions about the church being more traditional, more liturgical, like, what are they looking for? And I was assured that the person in the role before me was also a younger woman, and she was hired with the intention to kind of move the church forward in a more modern direction because they saw that the church was aging. And the choice to hire me was also intentional, that they wanted to move the church forward in a more modern direction with worship.
How long was Pastor B your boss?
He was my boss for a year and a half.
Okay. And how long were you at the church?
Almost 2 years.
Okay. So he was like your direct report for a year and a half?
Yeah.
That's helpful information. You got hired. Congrats.
Yeah.
You got the role. Maybe congrats. Congrats-ish. You got the role. What was it like stepping into that role?
Yeah, it was a big learning curve stepping into a full leadership, full-time staff position versus leading on a volunteer basis. And Pastor B was wonderful. I'm to this day so thankful for him. He really kind of held my hand along the way and encouraged me to make changes slowly. He would say one inch at a time, and also let me make mistakes, and then would like walk alongside me and explain like, here's a better choice next time, and was just so gracious about it. But the church was older and a lot more traditional, so any change they were pretty resistant to and vocal about what they didn't like, especially when it came to the music and worship side of things. So our staff would have a staff meeting once a week where we would go through the comment prayer cards that, if you're on a church staff, you're probably familiar with those and how nasty they can be, especially in smaller church settings. But I can't remember, honestly, a single week that we wouldn't read through those comment cards in front of the whole staff and there wouldn't be a comment mentioning something about a song they didn't like, or the music being too loud, or the lights being too dark, or something. So it kind of made me think, okay, the main issue at this church is the music, and the main source of complaints are towards the music.
And how is that handled with the staff in general when you're getting comments like that?
I would say because the staff was mostly older, those comments were usually agreed with. Like, oh yeah, it was too loud. Or I remember so clearly my first Sunday there, I introduced Good Good Father because that was like the awesome song at the moment. And oh my gosh, people hated it. They thought it was so repetitive. And the staff's like, yeah, it really was repetitive. I'm like, okay.
How dare you bring a Chris Tomlin song in here?
Oh, it wasn't Chris Tomlin at the time.
Who was it?
He did the cover of it. It was House Fires. I think that was Pat Barrett's like first big moment.
See, you just needed to wait till Chris Tomlin was the one, because they probably would have been totally fine with that.
I've actually thought of that, like, oh, dang it. If I waited till it got on K-Love, it would have been totally fine.
1,000%. So you're kind of, I mean, I think any worship leader knows that people have opinions. Like, everybody's gotten the lighting comments. Everybody's gotten the sound comments. Everybody's gotten the I didn't like that one song comments from people. How did you process through that? Were you able to kind of like work through those things? I know you're young. This is your first position. Pastor B kind of like worked through that with you and you felt supported.
Yeah, at the beginning, it was really hard because I didn't know the reality of how that would feel to be, I guess, kind of feeling like the object of people's complaints and like what I did was so harshly criticized. And it's not like we would open these comment cards and there would be complaints about the kids ministry or youth ministry. It was like, oh, the complaints are about worship every single week and they're read in front of everybody. So it felt almost embarrassing too. But Pastor B just really encouraged me to let it roll off my back as much as I could and not take them seriously. And he would remind me that it was a very vocal minority and not how the majority of people felt. And it wasn't representative of that.
How big was the church?
I would say at that point, they were averaging probably like 120 to 150. And they were in a transition period where their previous senior pastor had retired a couple years before that, and they were searching for a senior pastor, and a lot of people had left over that transition period because it was just so hard to not have any consistent leadership, and Pastor B didn't feel like enough to them because he was an executive or associate pastor.
Had Pastor B been there a long time?
Yeah, he was there when the previous pastor was there and was probably there 10, 15 years. So he was a familiar face.
Was there any talk about him taking that lead pastor role permanently?
Not really. And that was part of something that was hurtful for him. Mm-hmm. I know.
What was your dynamic like with other people on the staff?
Most of the staff was older than me. The youth pastor at the time was maybe 7, 8 years older than me, and that was the person closest to my age. So we kind of tried to find some solidarity with one another, but most of the rest of the staff was actually older women. And I didn't feel like I had much in common with them, but we were all friendly with each other and tried to getting to know each other.
You don't need to give the town or the city, but like, what was the demographic of the area that you were living in as far as what were the vibes?
This is a really diverse and progressive area of the state. Where I went to school, it was really culturally diverse. Most people voted left-leaning, also very intelligent people, very driven people, successful people. People are really busy in that area as well.
Would you say that this congregation, although it's older, kind of reflected the areas surrounding it and the city, the town that you were in?
No, not at all, because it was mostly white and older and more conservative.
Helpful. So you guys are in this weird space where you're honestly, you're reformed, but you're an egalitarian version of reformed and older, white, pretty conservative, if not just outright conservative, in the midst of a very progressive community. It's fascinating. Yeah. So you're kind of in like a very weird tension just in general as a church. And then as a young woman coming into this space, probably with more ideals surrounding like the progressive side of things and why you were in that place for school and your friends, the people that you surround yourself with probably would not have been that same demographic of just significantly older white conservatives.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to be in a church community with people my age, people in the same stage of life as I was, but that wasn't really available there.
Right. And that was a hope for you guys, it sounds like, with bringing you onto staff, was that this could potentially bring new life, younger people into the congregation because there's somebody that looks like them on the stage.
Yeah, which I think is interesting now, like being on church staff for a while, is like hiring someone that you want to represent a group of people that you want to start attending your church is not a magic fix for those people attending your church if there's nobody else there that represents them. Like, you can't make a diversity hire and then expect that that's just going to magically show up at your church because they're on stage now.
You can't?
Are you sure
you
about that?
You mean you have to do
it? There's some men that would disagree with you.
Most do, yeah.
All right, that's super helpful. I want to move into really the bulk of your story and why you're here sharing on Bodies Behind the Bus today. So during this season, you've mentioned it's in a transition. Their former pastor had retired, and you are hired. A new pastor is brought in, and he's the new leader. He's got the vision and the direction of the church. What is that like for you?
Yeah, so the church was really eager for Pastor L to come on, and I was too. In my time there, there was someone else that was brought out as a candidate, and the church was so hopeful. It felt like that season of waiting was coming to an end, and then that candidate ended up saying no after being voted in, and it was just devastating for the church and so sad. So when Pastor L comes out for his interview weekend and it feels even more promising and more like a good fit for this community, everyone is really hopeful, and I was really hopeful too. And part of that was because the weekend that he came and was there teaching and doing his whole interview process, he and his wife were in the front row and they were visibly engaged in worship, and they had their hands raised, their eyes closed, they were singing. And afterwards, they encouraged me and said how much they loved the worship and just modeled that participation well. And that gave me hope that, hey, this guy's going to come in and he's going to lead our church through this change in this next season of leadership, including changes in worship that has been different than what this community has expected or experienced in the last decade or so at that church. So I had already felt so vulnerable in my position on staff, believing from my perspective in our staff meetings that my ministry area was the major source of complaints at the church. So my hope was, this guy's going to come in, he's going to cast vision for how our church is going to move forward with the music ministry, and that would kind of put a stop to these complaints.
Can you walk us through like your first interactions with Pastor L, what that was like?
Yeah, my first interactions with him before he came on staff and then in his first couple weeks on staff was really encouraging. He spoke highly of the music and how much he loved it and told me often how much he loved my voice, what a great musician I was, or what a great singer I was. And this made me feel really valued by him and really believed in. But it wasn't until later that I looked back and noticed, oh, his encouragement was only ever in the product I produced. It wasn't in any leadership qualities. It was just in, oh, you're a great musician, you're a great singer.
That's tough. That actually sounds a lot like Jonna's story in a lot of ways too, Jonna. You had very similar interactions with Pastor H. So I was struck by something that he said to you in an early meeting, which when we had our conversation about, he asked you what sin you struggled with, which is such an inappropriate thing to ask, in my opinion. Can you walk us through that meeting, set it up for us, and tell us kind of how you responded and what you were thinking during that meeting?
Yeah, so Pastor L had not met on staff very long, maybe like a month at this point, and was settling into his role and having direct report meetings with each staff person. And in our first ever direct report meeting, he sits me down and asks me point blank what sin I struggled with the most. And this was really shocking and uncomfortable for me. And I was totally taken aback and felt put on the spot and pressured to answer and have like a satisfying answer for him too. So I didn't want to be seen as like secretive or like I had something to hide or maybe that I was unwilling to engage in this question. And he had talked about authenticity and vulnerability being such a big value. So I was like, okay, what can I say that will answer this question and kind of honor what he's saying while also not being too vulnerable with this person I barely know? So I said, well, I guess every worship leader struggles with pride to some extent. So me too. And then he afterwards is like, wow, I can't believe you shared that. That's so vulnerable of you. And I'm like, I don't know what you expected me to say and like what answer you were hoping for or thought I would say and why that was so significant. But I think honestly, Christian evangelical culture pressures us in these moments to be vulnerable beyond what's comfortable for us and beyond what's wise or safe, and to deny our gut feelings and what we're feeling in our body and our heart that's saying, no, don't open up right now, because the Bible says our heart is wicked. So we kind of take that out of context and say, oh, if your heart is saying no, then you're wrong, actually. But it was not the right choice for me to open up to someone that I knew only a few weeks at that point, because after that, when I would begin to disagree with him or push back on anything, this would be what he would call back to and say, hey, remember that first meeting? You were so vulnerable with me, and I appreciated that you said you struggle with pride. Well, guess what? That's coming up again right now.
And like, what do you say back to that?
Yeah.
You have nothing.
It's like, I already said that.
Right. And also how dismissive, because then you can't say anything at all without being in sin.
And I processed this with my therapist a couple months ago, and her first response was, wow, what do you think he would have said if you instead said, well, why don't you share what you struggle with the most first? And I was like, oh, where were you like 10 years ago? That was a great idea.
Also, none of us, I mean, I would still struggle to say that to a pastor today. Like that would be frightening to me to say that to my boss.
To ask a pastor what they struggle with. Why don't you share what you struggle with? That would be.
Well, especially,
will you go first?
Yeah. But especially in a boss employee situation, adding that extra dynamic is hard. But really, truly, like a church leader that I felt like I was, that they were in a leadership role in my life, I would struggle with that less since starting this podcast. But I know I would be pushing through fears to say that back. Like that would be a very strong, self-assured, healed response if I was able to do that. So,
oh yeah.
Heck yeah. 10 years ago, there's no way I could have done that. So don't beat yourself up too much about that.
I also am fascinated because I think about that, like the audacity of an individual to think they have a right to ask you that question in any type of setting is like blows me away. And Taylor hit the nail on the head when she said like, we're like almost like, that's like what we do. Like we're taught to go that deep or ask those questions. And like, that's just not cool. Like we need to totally throw that away and start by relationships by just getting to know an individual and respecting more boundaries. And I agree with you that we cross boundaries all of the time in these spaces because we feel like that's like the right thing to do. And I just don't, when I read the gospel, I don't see Jesus crossing those boundaries. I see Jesus staying within those boundaries. And I do see him crossing boundaries in the sense of make us uncomfortable, like social economic boundaries or ethnic boundaries, to where he comes into places where people would perceive him to be like, that guy shouldn't be here. And he's like, absolutely, I should be here. And we should be having these types of interactions. But he's never crossing personal boundaries like that. And I just feel sorry for you. I'm sorry that happened. Like my body cringes when thinking about how I would respond to that too. It's a tough place to be.
Well, and outside of ministry,
it's not happening.
How wildly inappropriate would that be for a boss to be like, so can you please tell me what you feel like is your biggest character flaw or like most vulnerable struggle that you have in your personal life so that I'm just aware as your boss.
Yeah.
Like that's not a thing.
And then they use it. And then they use it later down the line. So,
hey, you know how you said like sometimes you struggle with anxiety? Well, you bringing this up right now, I think that we're just going to chalk it all up to anxiety and not actually a real concern. Like that's not,
it's
that
crazy.
Doesn't, it maybe happens, but it's not happening as widespread as it is in evangelical spaces for sure.
Oh, yeah.
So clearly right off the bat, that's weird. Like 1 month in. But you didn't just have 1 month and then it was over. That snowballed, like you said. So can you walk us through what it was like working with Pastor L? Explain how things started to kind of unravel with your role and that working relationship.
Yeah, we hit some bumps in the road right away. One of the first ones being he came in and wanted to make a shift for our staff, having them be in the office working Sunday through Friday, because that modeled the Genesis 6 days of work, 1 day of rest. That was already just kind of interesting because that was his own personal conviction that then became everybody else's in that moment.
Did you get paid an extra 8-hour day?
No.
Mm-hmm.
This was really sad for me because I was just a couple months married at that point, and my husband works Saturdays. So when I got this new schedule, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to have 0 days a week with my husband. This is really sad. So I came to him and was pretty tearful and just saying, hey, we're going to have no days together. We're just a few months married. Can you please make an exception? And he pushed back pretty hard at me. One of the reasons being that he said Sunday is not a work day because we have volunteers there and they work Monday through Friday. But my volunteers can say no at any point. I can't say no at any point. I don't have that liberty. So I just kept asking for the sake of my family life. And he eventually said that I was allowed to have Fridays off, but that came at another cost of any time that I would disagree with him. He would say, well, hey, remember how I gave you Fridays off? And that was so generous of me. Why are you disagreeing with me right now?
I mean, it's so manipulative that he even did that. But also, like, the guy's like recalling things, like he's purposely referencing conversations that you've had to manipulate your feelings and the emotions in that situation. And I mean, that's just so wrong. And it's wrong at any level of leadership, but especially someone who's supposed to be a chief shepherd. In addition to your boss, he's a chief shepherd of your church and you as well. And how that doesn't model anything Christ-like at all. It models a very manipulative, selfish type of leadership that benefits him, which is just so unhealthy. How did you process that? What were you thinking? Like, did you have a lot of shame? Did you feel bad? Like, what was that like for you?
Absolutely. I felt so guilty. And this also added to this narrative that I think honestly still goes on today about millennials and Gen Z and younger, that we just don't want to work. We're lazy. We don't want to be in the office. So part of this and other things that happened along the way formed this view of myself in my mind that I'm just lazy and I'm not a hard worker because I don't want to be there on Fridays and I would rather be at home with my husband.
Where's Pastor B during all of this?
When this change was made, he was only on staff for about a month longer because we had budget cuts and he was the first to go, which was really heartbreaking. But he also lived an hour away with no traffic. So he worked from home a lot of time. And then with traffic, that commute is like 2 hours and sucks. So he was pretty upset about this as well and didn't like that idea. But I think he also saw the writing on the wall that he was going to be laid off pretty soon. So he was laid off about a month after this.
Did Pastor L work the same schedule Sunday through Friday?
He did.
Okay. Well, at least he showed up in the office.
Oh, for real.
Wasn't taking coffee meetings and long lunches.
Oh, well, I guess, yeah, he did.
He did that too.
He did do that.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
That's good. He needs those.
So there was a lot of flexibility in his schedule.
His schedule.
Would you say that you had that same flexibility and ability to?
No. No, the expectation was that I would be there in the office. So at first I was super confused not seeing him there when I would be there in the morning. And then it's like, oh, it's because he's meeting with congregants. So that makes sense.
There's a lot of pastors that meet with a lot of congregants, I think, throughout the week. There's a lot of those meetings that happen.
I'm not saying this about Pastor L. You could probably confirm or not, but I don't think they're actually meeting with very many congregants.
I don't either.
I know. I was meeting with them. I was like, who are you meeting with? I'm stuck meeting. Like, I'm here doing all the meetings. Who are you meeting with? I'm sure.
There's a lot of lunch meetings with themselves. So I have a question, though. Like, did you have a clear understanding of, like, your role and responsibilities from Pastor L? Because it sounds like there was a lot of ambiguity with, the like, what you did throughout the day. Was that clear as far as your role and expectations?
Yeah, it was not, because once I came on staff, I had looked at her website, which was very 1995. I was like, I have no experience in web design or graphic design, but this is so bad. I think I can fix this. So I presented to the staff, hey, let's use this church builder website. Like, we'll make it look better, more visually appealing, more easy to navigate. So I kind of took that on because it was something that I wanted to do, not because it was something that I was trained in or good at. But once Pastor L came on, he also had a pretty strong passion for web design, for graphic design, what he wanted all of that to look like. And he began focusing my job responsibilities primarily around graphics being made, the website being redone. And most of my time was in that. And because it wasn't my expertise and my specific skill set,
I didn't have the skills necessary to get the graphics exactly how he would want them. So then when I couldn't get them to that and tried to just finish the product, that was also something that added to this narrative of I'm lazy, I'm not doing a good job, I'm not putting out a perfect product. And we also had a lot of disagreements on what graphics should look like and what the website should look like. So I immediately felt just pretty confused about my priorities being redirected to something that was not my primary job responsibility, and that really I volunteered on staff to take that on.
It's impossible to put that on you and that's not even your job, and they should just hire someone to do the website. To me it speaks to the type of control that must be going on within your staff dynamic that is not only untenable, but it's unattainable, in my opinion, for you to ever reach a place to where you satisfy him. Is that a fair statement?
Oh, yeah. And it's also just because I don't have the skill level of a graphic designer to get things exactly right. And I was just doing my best. Mm-hmm. And in these like smaller churches, I feel like everybody's role ends up being a little scrappy. Mm-hmm. And you take on things that aren't it a part of your job responsibility and that you're not amazing at, but there's got to be grace in those areas. And there just wasn't for me.
Mm. Was there ever a point where your role was written down? Like you had a job description role where you knew this is the responsibilities expected of me?
Yeah. Graphic design and web design was not on that.
Not shocking, but interesting. Okay. So it seems that you had a decent amount of conflict. Would you say this was like explosive conflict or just like little things like, hey, I'm actually not able to make this graphic the way that you want it to be? And the response was, figure it out. Like, can you walk us through a little bit of that?
Yeah. When I would push back maybe on how a graphic looked or something that he wanted on the website or even stage design, anything like that, that he was pushing really hard for. If I would push back, that's when he would bring up my pride being the reason as to why I was disagreeing with him. Or he would just point blank ask me, hey, do you trust me? With anyone in a position of leadership, like your boss or someone with spiritual authority over you, like a pastor, it's really hard to hear that question, do you trust me? And respond to that with anything but yes. You don't really feel like you have a choice. But the more that we would get into these little disagreements, the more that would bleed over into Sunday services. That when he and his wife first came and they would be in the front row right on time for worship, singing and participating and modeling that, he ended up, if we had a bad week that week, he'd come in and just stand there and scowl at me and not sing and like cross his arms, or he'd even sit down and just read over his message. That was hard to look at and have that be right in front of me as I was leading worship. So honestly, kind of made even Sundays a hostile environment for me the more that we got into conflict, because it's not even passive aggressive, I guess, but like a quiet aggressiveness.
It's intentional.
Well, it's modeling. Yeah, and it's modeling to the congregation that your role in that portion of the service actually doesn't matter.
Oh, that's valid, Jonna. That's a great point.
And I wondered, like, are people noticing that there's a shift? Mm. Because did they see him singing before and now he's not? So what changed?
Would anybody from the staff ever come up and say something to you if that happened? Like, did they notice it? Other staff members?
Honestly, pretty much everyone, because it was such a small staff, would be in their respective areas of ministry during the service. So no one was really in there to witness this but me.
Mm. I think when people hear there was conflict going on, they immediately think that there's a connotation that comes with that you're just constantly being like dismissive of what your boss is wanting, or purposely being attitude-y, especially for women. But younger staff members in general, I've seen this happen with men and women, get this kind of reputation for being hard to work with. So I think it would be really helpful for you to explain what was like a conflict surrounding stage design. Can you explain what that means when you say something like that? Because I think a lot of people immediately are going to this like sassy conflict space where that's not necessarily what that looks like in that moment. And Pastor L might not have even called it a conflict, but you call it a conflict right now. And I'd be interested to see what that looks like for you.
Yeah, with stage design specifically, when he first came on, he, like many pastors coming into a new role, changed the vision, mission statement to 4 words. And he really wanted those 4 words in like silver letters just on the stage permanently. I thought, hey, let's have that somewhere else in the auditorium. And he was like, it doesn't make sense anywhere else in the auditorium. It has to be in the stage. So that center. And I just kept redirecting it like, what if it's on this wall? What if it's on this wall? So that we can have a little more flexibility with what the stage looks like throughout the year around Christmas time, all of this, like this might limit us. And that was seen as me not supporting his vision. So it came back to me being divisive by suggesting something different.
And when you suggest something different, how much authority do you have to actually do something different? Or are you just suggesting something different?
I learned pretty quickly. I really did not have authority. If he wanted something, it was going to happen. But with this, because I pretty strongly pushed back, the big letters on the stage did not happen until I left staff.
Because it was hideous. And I remember when I first had a phone call with you, I like Googled it and saw that. I was like, oh, look, there's the letters.
So you know exactly yes. What I'm talking about and why I did not want that.
Yes. But it's just like ridiculous little things like that. It's silly to say those things out loud because I think to the average person who has not been on a church staff, you think this is so dumb, who cares? But those are the little things that take up so much unnecessary time are these conversations yes. where everyone's sitting around in a circle just talking about dumb letters that may or may not need to go on stage. Like the amount of focus that is put on just the dumbest stuff and that people that are hired to do a job are not actually allowed to have authority over, so their opinion doesn't matter. And then it's just a million opinions that are not actually qualified to be making those decisions that have say. It's exhausting. But it wasn't like you were flipping tables or punching holes in walls or yelling in the middle of the office about these letters. Am I correct yeah. on that? You're just saying like, hey, that doesn't sound like it's the best design decision for us moving forward because of these reasons. That's why I'm saying what I'm saying. And you're basically being called divisive.
Exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
And how often were those type of conflicts coming up in a week?
I would say the longer we work together, the more frequent, like pretty much any time we met together, so weekly.
And did you think there was ever a posture from Pastor L to actually hear what you were saying? Or was his mind set immediately in the conversation where he was going to get his way one way or the other?
I was pretty naive at the beginning that I think because of Pastor B giving me a voice, I kind of thought immediately I had a voice and then pretty quickly learned that that wasn't the case and that what Pastor L wanted he was going to get. And I was really just being informed about what he wanted. Another kind of like, not necessarily conflict, but I guess like disagreement that we ran into all the time was he would write his messages Sunday mornings at 4 a.m. because that's when the Holy Spirit would speak to him. So he would not give me any information until then. And being a super type A planner type of person who wants to plan a cohesive service, this was really frustrating to me. And I would ask him, hey, can you give me some info about what you're going to teach on? And at one point early on, he gave me like a list of like 10 topics that he may or may not talk about over the next year. And when I kept saying, hey, I need more than this, he's like, I gave you topics I might talk about. What else do you need from me? And I'm like, you don't understand my job. You don't know what I do and like why this matters. And this became especially frustrating planning Christmas services with him and him just refusing to give me any content.
I mean, the Holy Spirit's going to speak when he's going to speak. So we need to be mindful of that.
It's so frustrating because, again, this is just another example of not actually valuing your role. As a former worship leader, it's really, one, just discouraging. And I would, again, feel just like, what am I doing and why am I here? Like, what, you don't care about this. So what am I supposed, like, I am not equipped to actually do my role. So I can't actually shepherd the congregation through this service because I don't know what I'm doing. If my whole role is to stand on stage and sing and, like you said, be a product that's just musical and not actually shepherd, then I guess I can just throw the 5K love songs into the service and call it a day. But if my role is actually caring about worship, which is what being a worship leader is, you're actually, I mean, it matters that you're a capable musician, but really, truly, it's all about shepherding. And this push in services that a sermon is like this, the most pivotal part of the service. Worship leader Jonna, I actually don't think that. I personally believe like having communion together is probably the biggest part of a service, or that fellowship together, or corporate worship. The corporate part of it is why we're coming together on a Sunday, not the sermon. So if we're not actually focusing on the corporate part, what are we doing? It's so defeating. There's just, you're literally getting your hands tied behind your back, not able to do your job well, and then also getting cut down anywhere that you're supposed to have an opinion or voice.
Yeah.
It's exhausting. And yeah. You're young and a newlywed.
Oh, yeah. A lot going on for me at the moment.
Yeah. At one point, you mentioned in your story, your husband was an issue. Can you explain? So not only are you just all wrong and divisive, but also your husband is. So we can thank him for that. Can you explain what happened?
Well, I'll say, first of all, my husband was an issue because he was a drummer. So, and that kind of church.
Drums are always hated. The issue.
Yeah. So yeah, he was always a problem. And if you know him, he's the least problematic person you'll ever meet. And so peaceful. So that's just funny by itself. But we had various, usually old ladies volunteer in the office in the middle of the week as receptionists. So people were in the office that were congregants pretty often. So they knew where people's desks were. And I would get notes left on my desk kind of often. And usually it was something like, the volume was too loud this week, or I didn't like this song, the usual, and I'd just throw it away. But one week I get a note left that says, tell your husband to take his hat off during church. He wore a hat every week. So this wasn't a new thing, but it just felt really wrong to me. And it really hurt my feelings to see this, especially just knowing the character of my husband and that there was no name signed on this for me to follow up with anybody. They just kind of expected me to tell my husband to stop wearing a hat in church. So I bring this up to Pastor L and tell him, hey, this note really bothered me, really hurt my feelings this time. And he immediately points me to Romans 14 about that passage about, hey, if it causes your brother to stumble by eating meat, the best thing to do is to not eat meat. And in that moment, I felt so convicted and like, oh my gosh, he's right. I'm in the wrong for this. I should tell my husband to take his hat off in church. And I talked to a mentor of mine a little bit later about this, and he immediately is like, that is not the context of that passage. That passage is about not condemning each other and not judging one another, not about, hey, if this person is making a judgment about you, it's actually your fault and you need to fix it.
So ridiculous. So to me, after our phone call and hearing you talk now, you probably had that response to that note in particular because it was towards someone you loved. And it's easier sometimes when we're in those settings to see the injustice or the wrongness when someone we care about is experiencing boundary crosses or inappropriate behavior. And it's a lot harder to have that justice response when it's ourself in those settings. Probably a lot of psychological reasons that I am not qualified to say contribute to that. But I do find it noteworthy that your response immediately, you're like, I can throw away the ones that are about me, but when it was my husband, I needed to say something. And how sad that not only was the response to you continually, it's your pride, but now when it has to do with your husband, he also is not worth saying like, hey, that doesn't matter. And we're just so grateful that you guys are both here and that he's volunteering his time to help serve the church and just disregard it, people are going to be frustrating sometimes. So this is all just kind of falling apart. I think everybody listening is hearing it unravel. Can you talk about what was going down with music? In particular, how the congregation was responding? Again, you're getting weird stuff from day one about music from the congregation. This is a big part of your role. How is Pastor L responding to that feedback from the congregation? What is expected of you and how you respond to it? And it kind of culminates with an elders meeting. So can you walk us through how we got there?
Yeah. Well, early on in Pastor L being there, he told me that there was a growing group of people that were, in his words, protesting the music by staying in the lobby and waiting until the music was over and then coming into service afterwards. And for me, being in the role that I was in, it was impossible to watch this happen or to see who these people are and follow up with them because I have responsibilities during the time that this would be going on. So when he told me this, I asked him immediately, hey, do we need to lower the volume? What do we need to do? Like, let me know what I need to change. And I can put myself exactly where I was with him and him saying so sternly and looking at me and saying, you don't have to do anything. I love what you're doing. I support what you're doing. And these people are being divisive. And when he said that, it was so sincere. It felt like that I believed him. And I felt relieved, like, okay, this has been an ongoing concern, and this is someone who's going to navigate this well and pastor these people through the change in music that they're obviously grieving and struggling with. But I thought, okay, this is the end of it. He's going to lead through this really well. So I felt kind of like my fears were taken care of in that moment. But around this time, he had started this sermon series called Processed Christianity, which confuses everybody anytime I tell them that. But what it means is like processed food, junk food. So the whole series was about real Christians versus fake Christians or processed Christians. So some of his examples for processed Christianity were like concert style music, fog, moving lights, all of that stuff that we did not have at our stained glass church with pews. But during this series, he told me about a man that came up to him after service every single week that he would not name to me, that came up to him and said, she is processed Christianity, talking about me. And this is when this took a shift, with the complaints being about maybe the product I was creating, to the complaints being a character judgment about who I was. He told me that he defended me to this man and that that wasn't who I was. So I thought, okay, this person's making judgments about my character, but my new boss has my back. He believes in me. But all of this just began to spiral and get worse. And this group of protesters in the lobby who refused to come into service, this mystery man that claimed that I was processed Christianity or fake Christian, Pastor L eventually is saying, hey, something's got to be done about this. And his first suggestion to me was that I have a meeting with all of these people that have been complaining about worship, standing out in the lobby, and hear them out on why they're not engaging with the music. And me being at this point a 21-year-old who had already my whole time on staff there, sat through staff meetings, hearing these mostly anonymous comment cards left about how much people disliked the music. The thought of being put in a room with a large group of people that had left those kind of notes and were complaining in this way about what I was doing, just kind of left to fend for myself. And that was extremely overwhelming. And Pastor L said he would be there, but I did not have any feeling that he would be on my side and that he would defend me or even mediate that conversation well. So I was not very excited about that option. So I asked him what his second idea was, which was a meeting with the elders to determine what the best course of action would be and kind of come up with a plan for how to move the church forward and address these complaints.
I'm so sorry that happened to you. The very cynical part of me is like, was this mystery man even a human? Or was he just like lying to you? And also why, even if it was a real person saying this, why tell you? And why not just shut that down immediately? Like, hey, that's sinful what you're saying right now. You're tearing down the character for no reason, unwarranted, of a woman in leadership at this church. Why even entertain that? And why entertain it to the point to tell you, like, all that did was cut you down?
That's what blows me away when I hear stories like this, like these men who say, you know, their primary goal is to defend women and, you know, love women as Christ loved the church, will abandon that immediately to shame or put themselves in a position of power and leave women or others out there to take all of that heat, unnecessary heat. And to me, like, I see it and like, it's almost like he relishes those moments when you're describing that, like to put you in that moment. And that to me is just some sort of evil that we need to call out and say, like, that is wicked and evil and unbelonging in any church. And I'm sorry, like, I know Jonna said she's sorry, but I'm just sorry that you had to like have that moment where your head is like spinning and you're like, I don't feel safe. I don't want to do this. But then you also feel like, but I have to do it. And I'm just sorry that you had to go through all that.
Oh, thank you. I didn't feel it in the moment. But now looking back, I'm like, why did he feel like he had to tell me? If this person really did say this, like if someone tells you the worst thing they could say about another person, why would your instinct be, let me tell them what was just said about them, instead of just shutting it down? Especially if this was happening week after week, like he said, clearly he wasn't really shutting it down.
Yeah, like why does that person feel comfortable walking back through those doors while they're in active sin towards a woman in the congregation? Like it's not like just like it was a one-off. It was active, perpetual sin. Gross. That's an offense and really upsetting. And I put myself in your shoes and think about what I would feel like if my only options were sit in a room with a bunch of nameless, faceless people, which I still, from the beginning of the first time I talked to you, I'm like, were they actually real? Like, was there a group of people that was protesting in the lobby? We don't know. Like, who were they actually there? Or was he just saying this stuff? Like, was he blowing something way out of proportion? Were there two old ladies sitting in the lobby that didn't want to be in the service or just like gabbing over a coffee, you know? Or was this like a real group of 20 people protesting in the lobby?
Yeah.
But I put myself in your shoes and think either I'm going to go to a place where I'm not allowed to defend myself or it's viewed as pride. I have no actual authority to make a decision surrounding my role. I don't have the capability of making them feel better because I'm being told we're trying to move in this direction with worship, yet their issue is with that direction. And I have no authority to say anything to it. I just have to listen. Or I have to go before the elders, which seems disciplinary, and fight for a solution that I have no power over. I have no power in this situation to fix anything. And everything that you are telling me is that I am the problem. So what's the solution? Is I have to go away. That's how I would feel. I don't know if that resonates with you, but while you're talking, that's what I'm feeling.
Oh, yeah. It became pretty clear that it was perceived that the problem was me and that the division was because of me and the choices I had made. So it was about fixing me, is what it felt like, at least. So it became very scary, honestly. I felt like my job was on the line.
And what would that have meant for you to lose that job to you?
That would have meant having to probably move in with my parents or in-laws, move out of the state because we had just gotten married, my husband and I, and renting in the area that we were in was super expensive. So we couldn't do that on just one person's salary. So losing this job without something else lined up would have been pretty detrimental.
So walk us through what that meeting was like with the elders. Was Pastor L there? Pastor L say something to you before the meeting? Things like that.
Well, I was pretty obviously nervous for this meeting with the elders, and Pastor L was aware of it. And at this point, our working relationship was pretty tense. We didn't agree on much. I was viewed as disagreeable, divisive, lazy, and overall just did not feel comfortable around him. The night of that meeting, I'm in the office and Pastor L comes up to me and asks me to come to his office so that he could prep me. And I said that I didn't want to, but he made it pretty clear that it wasn't a choice. He wanted to prepare me for this meeting. So
really quickly, when you say I said that I didn't want to, can you explain how you said you didn't want to?
I think I just said, I'm okay. I don't need any prep for this. But he said, no, this is important. I want to make sure you're prepared for this meeting.
Thank you. Okay.
So in this meeting, I sat down in a chair in his office and he's telling me how good he thinks this meeting is going to be for us all moving forward, that the elders really just wanted to hear my heart for worship and music and what I've been experiencing. And I just sat there and listened to him talk for a while. And then he asked if he could pray for me. And I had already felt so vulnerable and uncomfortable with him in that room. And I said no, that I did not want him to pray for me. And I think this was honestly the first time in my Christian life that I'd ever turned down an offer for prayer, because it felt like that was a not spiritual thing to do, I guess. Like, in what Christian circle do you say, no, thank you, I don't need prayer? But he completely ignored my no. He didn't even say, well, I'd like to pray for you anyways, or I think this is really important that we pray. He actually just moved forward and started praying anyways out loud for me. And I remember absolutely freezing and just looking at him, kind of hunched over, furrowed brow, intensely praying. And I almost am like blacking out and not hearing any of it and just watching this happen, that, oh my gosh, I said no, that I didn't want this and it didn't matter because you wanted to. So after he finished praying, I honestly felt gross and like a boundary was crossed and something spiritual was violated for me. And I just got up quickly and said thank you and walked back to my desk and just felt like there was something so wrong about that moment for me. Which now, after tons of therapy, I can connect that when I was 13, I was sexually assaulted. And similarly, in that experience, I froze and just waited for that moment to pass, because that's how my body and my brain decided to protect myself. And that feeling of violation was so similar. It was on a different level of my spiritual boundaries were crossed and not respected, versus my physical boundaries were crossed and not respected. But in both senses, when someone says no and we ignore that, even in a spiritual setting, it is wrong.
I'm so sorry. Thank you for sharing that. And also, it's just so gross and so unnecessary and such an indicator of your worth in his eyes, and the fact that your voice, your boundaries, your personhood did not matter to him in that moment, and that he was going to do what he wanted to do no matter what. And like, who was he praying to? Like, what? That is not of God. Like, what was the purpose? It was for himself to feel better, or for himself to be able to look more spiritual? Like, it wasn't for you.
Yeah.
I think when your first email came in and you described that feeling, I immediately thought, how many people, like how many of us have experienced something like that and our bodies responded the same way and we haven't been able to tie those things together yet? I think it's just a really pertinent example of what spiritual abuse and pastors or religious leaders that do not respect boundaries, what that is doing to people. It is violating. And our bodies are responding the same way that they are when there's like a sexual boundary that's crossed or an assault that happens. Yeah. So I know that we have pastors that are listening. I know we have church leaders that listen. You need to hear that that is what is happening to souls when you are not respecting boundaries and when you are viewing a person as not a human, but like a number or something to be won or something to fix rather than an image bearer of God. It's so wrong. And I'm so sorry that you experienced that. And that you experienced that and then had to immediately go into a room of elders. So, yikes. Oh, yeah. How do you walk in there after that? Like, clearly you at the moment, like you said, it took therapy for you to start connecting those dots that my body responded the same way. I experienced this the same way. And this trauma lives in me the same way and needs to be healed. In that moment, you're not thinking that. You're just thinking, I feel wrong. Something feels gross. I don't know what to do. And I also have to go do my job now. You walk in those doors. Yeah. How does that go? Do you remember that even?
I remember. I feel so much of my experiences there are blurs, and my body mostly remembers like the anxiety that I felt and everything. But I remember just even feeling like, well, I was wrong in the first place for saying no to prayer. So I guess I deserve to be prayed for anyways. I don't know. You just kind of gaslight yourself in that situation. But I walked into the elders meeting that night and they mainly asked me questions about the complaints that I was getting. And I shared about things I heard, like songs being too repetitive, that I didn't do enough hymns, that I closed my eyes too much during worship, that the house lights were too dark, you know, the laundry list that I had gotten. And they mainly just listened. But I do remember one elder bringing up that he had heard that I sang too low for the guys, which is really funny to me. At the time, I thought I was an alto. Now I'm a soprano and like realize I wasn't singing in the right spot for my voice. But at the same time, I'm like, the complaints have not stopped in that sense that I think no matter what, we always want to center what a man wants in worship. Like, oh, well, this is too uncomfortable for the guys. Even though they sing along the least in church, let's center them so that they're super comfortable. So, and a woman's voice is just never quite right for that. So that was just like a really interesting comment that stuck with me. But I left that meeting and I knew that basically I was there to kind of say my side of what I was experiencing and I was going to leave. And then they were going to come up with an action plan, the elders and Pastor L. And that was just really nervous. And based on that meeting and things leading up to it, I began to kind of put pieces together and suspect that I was going to be given some pretty serious parameters around what I would be allowed to do on a Sunday morning, and really suspected I'm going to get a list of songs that I'm allowed to play. And if that happens, my husband and I were already praying and processing together that that would be a sign that this just wasn't a good fit for us anymore, the direction that it was going. And that would be our sign from God that it was time to move on.
I think it's funny when people say like you closed your eyes too much. Like, do these people not go to like concerts, like where bands are playing? And I mean, like, I always wonder, like when people complain about music, like what is their relationship with music outside of the church? Because music is such an emotional and vibrant thing that like it brings forth all of these emotions. I want my person who's reading worship to be filled with like emotions when they sing and express that. Like, that's what attracts me to like the bands that I like or the music that I like. I don't listen to like monotone people talking and not dancing, even though I can't dance or anything like that, nor would I ever dance, Jonna. But I still want to see people do that. Like, that's what I like about music.
What they wanted from her. They wanted her to be like, Lord, I lift your name.
But they don't
want
that.
With her big eyebrows.
No, they don't want
yes,
that.
They did.
They want that.
That person did.
Oh.
Yes.
I don't want that.
For sure. They wanted like Righteous Gemstones. Like the, like.
That's a great show.
Yeah, it's a little too close to home, but it is funny. I have a question for you. Was this meeting presented as if it was a disciplinary meeting, or was it presented as a this like we're coming together to figure out what the next steps are?
It was not presented disciplinary. It was more like, hey, let's all figure this out mm-hmm. together.
So,
but I didn't really take it that way.
No. You can write the action plan with them, right?
They yeah. Write you were not it. Involved yeah. in the conversation surrounding what do we do next? So again, these yeah. are situations that are very common in church staffs that people don't understand what that's actually doing. It's again, disempowering you to do your role, to have a voice in your role. You have no agency or understanding of what the direction is. You are there to be plugged into a spot and to fit all of the things that they want. You're there to be a product and you're not there to be a voice. Your voice did not matter in that situation.
Well, I don't know how it's collaborative or productive if I'm going to bring someone in and basically be like, here's, it's like the Seinfeld reference when they say, here's all the ways that you disappoint me. That's what it feels like they're doing, like sitting you down and being like, I'm going to read you a list of every way that you've failed. And you're just expected to like absorb that, which is absurd and not, I mean, like if we're going to throw the Christian word out there, like that's not very Christ-like or biblical a way to approach any type of disagreement or any type of work conflict in any way, but we're just going to do that. And then they like cast that emotional weight on you and you're like, okay, I guess I wait now to see what they decide, which is insane, which is insane.
Yeah, it never even dawned on me. Like, it's weird that I'm not involved in the yes. process of, if we're actually figuring something out, like, how do we move forward? Why am I not involved in this process? I'm completely removed from it.
Yep. Was the elder team affirming of the things that the congregation was saying, or were you at least having some people be like, this is ridiculous?
Some of them were a little more on the ridiculous side. I would say the majority of them, they didn't love the direction of music, but I would say all of them appreciated me and were affirming of my leadership, even if they didn't like the style of music, which honestly was not even that different from what it was before. So I am still confused about what was so different that I was doing.
Okay. So, I mean, very clearly, you are just being made into the smallest possible thing in this entire situation. What did they come back to you with, and how long did it take them to come back to you with action steps?
So it was just a couple weeks after that first meeting. I knew that there was naturally going to be a second follow-up meeting to discuss the plan that they came up with after I left the room. And Pastor L called me into his office a couple weeks later and said that he had a letter for me from him and the elders. And he thought, knowing that I'm an internal processor and an introvert, that having something given from them in writing for me to process ahead of time would be most honoring to me, which I totally see the thought process behind that. And I guess can validate it a little bit, because I would have been blindsided in the meeting if I was told what was in this letter without time to process it ahead of time. But this was done in a way that was extremely impersonal. And this letter was written really businessy, if that makes sense. The letter said that effective that coming Sunday, and if a letter says effective by, it feels very corporate and weird, that I would only be allowed to play songs from the list of about 15 to 20 that they had below. And this even included a list of approved hymns that I was allowed to play, and that was limited. And what I noticed right away was over the 2 years that I'd been there, I had slowly worked songs into the rotation one at a time, really slowly, because that was the coaching that I'd gotten from Pastor B on how to do that in a way that was honoring to this congregation. And none of the songs that I'd introduced in the last 2 years were on that list. And many of them I'd never heard before. Many of the hymns I'd never heard before because they were a little obscure. So when I got this letter, it was exactly what I had expected would happen and had talked to my husband and God about, that if that happened, I would know that it was time to move on. So I decided that I'd be quitting. And this whole process became so exhausting. And my relationship with Pastor L just felt emotionally unsafe at this point, too.
What is like the age range of the elders team?
80 plus.
Okay, I am like, yeah, dying laughing over here, as horrific as this story is, at the idea of like a table of like 80 plus probably white individuals like, let's make a playlist. Somebody, like, what's your favorite song?
Somebody brings out an old hymn book they've had since the 40s, and they're like, here you go.
You guys ever heard Yes, Lord? That's a bop. Like, what?
Like, oh, that was definitely
I'm positive it was. I am like,
yeah,
cringing so hard. And I mean, I would do the same thing. I'd be like, I'm sorry, no. I'm going to go somewhere
where... Like, how crazy is it to say, like, for a worship leader, be like, you can only pick 20 songs. Like, that's absurd.
So, it is normal to have a canon. So, like, I'm sure you did the same thing. Like, when she talks about working something into rotation, you have a pool of songs that you are making sure the congregation is familiar with so that you're not constantly throwing new things at them so they can actually engage in worship.
Yeah.
But normally, it's not like you can only do these songs. None of them are ones that you would suggest or have ever led. And you can't add. Like... What?
Wow.
Yeah, goodbye. Like, no, I would rather move in with my parents or my in-laws than have to do this. Yuck.
So what did you do? What did you do after you got the letter?
I immediately called my husband and just said, I think the first words out of my mouth were, I'm quitting. It happened. He knew exactly what I was talking about, and I drove home and was crying and... read it to him, showed it to him. He was really shocked. And then at that point, I think the meeting was going to be like a week or something from that point. I had some time to process, which I also really appreciate. And I wrote out a resignation letter.
I want to know, like, did you read that letter to them or did you send that before the next meeting?
I read it in the meeting.
Good for you for reading it. Honest, because I'm an introvert too. So good for you for being like, no, I'm reading this thing. Good for you.
Yeah. It is not what they expected. And I also, I can look back at this decision. And I was 21 and I've reread this resignation letter. And I'm like, wow, that was emotional and a little dramatic. And I can regret some of that, but not my choice. And I remember feeling so guilty for not telling Pastor L ahead of time that I was going to be quitting. And this was like around... January, February. And I told them that I would stay on through Easter because I thought that would be really kind to kind of give them that buffer. And Easter was like in April that year or something. And that I would do the list, but that I needed like a couple weeks to learn the songs because I didn't know them. Yeah, I remember just feeling so guilty that I did not give Pastor L a heads up ahead of time. And he and the rest of the elders were so angry and shocked in that meeting when I read that letter.
What type of emotional things were in that letter? Like, were you saying, I don't feel valued here?
Yeah. So I guess I like just view that as me being a little emotional. Like I said, that I didn't feel valued, that everything that I had done over those last 2 years was not appreciated, and that they communicated to me that they didn't want me as a worship leader. They wanted someone completely different.
Which they did.
So you basically
told the
truth. Just straight. Yeah. You just told them what had happened.
Yes. But since I'm a woman, it was inherently emotional.
Yes. So you actually maybe didn't do anything wrong by saying what you said and reading what you read, but you're taking on the patriarchy did it, and they did not like that. Did they tell you that it was emotional and inappropriate what you said?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they did. I also had a mentor at the time that was a man, and he was really helpful, but he did also help me go through several drafts of it that were more emotional, mm-hmm, and like cut some things out that I'm really thankful for. Yeah. Because my first couple drafts were messy and a little honest. So he helped me through that. So he also called out some of my, like, I'm an Enneagram 4. So it's like, mm-hmm, I wear my heart on my sleeves. And he was kind of helping me dial that back a little. Mm-hmm. So I think I like live a little bit in that whole process, because that was so huge for me.
Yeah.
Having someone kind of walk me through how to do this in the best way I possibly could while still being honest.
It's also really hard to do that if you were, and we'll get to, you wanted to continue in ministry, or you did continue in ministry. So that's a very interesting tightrope that you are walking, because you have to present, like, you can't really be fully honest in those settings and continue with a reference. And I think that's gross. And there's nothing else to say besides that. But that just is what it is. Like, I mean, when I left, Jay, like, I knew I'm burning it down.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to say this stuff out loud, and I'm never going to get a job again if I say this stuff out loud.
I think it's odd, though, that the reaction that you said, Taylor, was that they were angry. So when you have someone that's pouring out their heart and soul about how they've been treated in a situation, and instead of reflecting on that as a pastor in a leadership group to say, you know, this person has gotten to this position and feels this way and is communicating something, we've clearly done something here or missed something that we need to reflect on. The immediate response is anger, which just speaks to the posture of leadership and speaks to where the sin in this situation lies. And it's not on the side of Taylor by any means. And I think it's important for church leaders to understand, when we're constantly centering ourselves as church leaders, we're not able to hear and see others. And we are, by doing that, creating situations where people are being harmed. And if someone comes to us intentionally and shares, here's my experience in this situation with you as an individual and as a leader, and we're not reflecting on that and not seeing how we can take ownership, the sin belongs with you. It does not belong with the other individual. And that needs to be wrestled with.
Like, what did you do to make them angry? That deserved anger.
She read a letter.
Just the fact that you resigned?
Yeah, I've thought back to this, and I hadn't until literally yesterday realized, oh, wow, I wonder if their perspective of this was maybe that we would come in and have a conversation and come to, like, hey, if you don't like this, let's come to a mutual decision together, instead of me coming in and saying, this is not going to work. This is what I feel you've communicated to me, and I'm not a good fit anymore. So I think they were genuinely shocked that what they had communicated to me led me to a decision to quit rather than try to work through things. But what the elders at least had not experienced was that anytime I was trying to be heard, I wasn't with Pastor L. So I don't think I had any hopes that they would hear me either.
So what happens? You read this letter, they're mad. What happens? Like, are you still in this meeting? Do you leave? Walk us through it.
Yeah. Well, again, this is kind of like a blur to me, but I just remember being chewed out and just a lot of, I can't believe you're quitting. This is so reactive. Please reconsider.
That is so weird. That is so weird. You know that now, right? Like,
oh, I know that now.
10 years later, you're like, that is weird.
I was just absolutely chewed out. And I can look back on my resignation letter and say, okay, you know, it might have been emotional or anything, but really my mentor helped me to not place any responsibility on anyone but myself. Like, to say, when this happened, I felt this way. Because, you know, that's like the emotionally immature way to say it. So, hey, when I was handed this letter, I felt this, and it is causing me to make this decision. So there was like, I labored over this letter, went through like 3 revisions with my mentor. My husband was there with me through that process. So I come home from that meeting and I see him through like the window in our door, and I am weeping because I had held it in that whole meeting. And I walk in and like collapse, and the words out of his mouth are, I don't understand how that could have gone badly. And I didn't either. I was shocked because I had worked so hard for it to go well.
Something I have learned about many pastors that have tendencies like the ones that your former boss had is, in particular, I think Enneagram 4s are like the art, like the enemy number one of leaders that lead with narcissistic tendencies, because people that lead like that really hate when things are mirrored back at them. So you didn't feel like you were doing anything by saying, when this happened to me, it made me feel like this. But I'll tell you, in my own personal experience, when I did that with my boss, that's right, I was fired right then. Because he didn't want to hear how his actions made me feel. He just wanted to be allowed to do whatever he did and not have to have any responsibility for that. So for you to say, this thing that happened to me made me feel this way in that moment, that was like confronting them. And they took it as you being contentious, probably, by saying, just mirroring back like, hey, when you said this, it made me feel like this. And that is so ridiculous. Like, these are the things where you're teaching kindergarten children to do with each other in conflict. But church leaders in particular that are leading with narcissistic tendencies cannot handle that. Like, 0% can handle that. So that's why it didn't go good. You were mirroring back to someone who was not okay with taking responsibility with how their actions actually affect people. Did you mention the prayer in that letter?
No. I did mention that I thought me stepping aside from my role would be good for the sake of Pastor L's needs for someone who was more comfortable with someone who is more spontaneous, I guess, on Sundays, rather than like a type A person like me who wanted to plan. So I like mentioned some of those like differences we had in our like working styles. But I didn't mention anything about the way that he treated me. I did not feel safe to.
Was the elder board aware that you were only getting services at 4 a.m. on a Sunday before that letter?
I'm not sure, but it was so over spiritualized
right.
that I don't think it was going to be seen as anything. But oh, wow. Like you wrote a whole message the morning of. That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, Pastor L also might have felt exposed because things that he was doing to you in the work relationship were now being put out there for everyone to see. And most like normal, logical human adults would be like, yeah, that's not actually something conducive to her job. Like, she can't do her job if you do this, which would have probably looked like him having to make changes to his flow and what he wanted to do. Which, dude, you have 6 days. You're doing a 6-day work week. You can't. The Holy Spirit doesn't only work on Sunday mornings. I didn't know if you guys knew that or not. Like, there's not only just like 3 hours on a Sunday morning that the Holy Spirit's like, let's get to work. Goodness. So you're a hot mess. You just got picked apart for quitting in, I'm assuming, a very respectful way, but honest way. Based upon our engagements and the things that you have said, do you just leave the church? Are you having, you're serving till Easter? What does that look like?
I had offered until Easter, but once again, I left the meeting and then they continued to talk after I left and was dismissed. And they had decided, I think it was like 4 weeks or something instead. Easter would have been like 10 weeks, I think. So they wanted me out a little quicker. So that was the news I got. And I had applied to a couple of churches a little bit before this, but hadn't taken them super seriously. But once I got this letter, I was like, okay, I guess I'm really in the running for these two jobs. So I started to kind of take those interviews more seriously at this point.
And then you had a situation too, where one of the jobs ghosted you, correct? After they called Pastor L?
Yeah. So both interview processes were going well for these two churches, and one of them was out of state. And they were really enthusiastic about me and ready to fly me out to do the last portion of the interview process. But they had a requirement that they wanted me to put my current manager down as a reference. And I told them, hey, I've got other references on there that I've worked with longer that I'd love for you to talk to. But my current manager and I don't really see eye to eye. I don't think that's going to be the best person for you to talk to. But they absolutely insisted. So I put Pastor L down as a reference. And then I got an email from them
from this church saying that they were no longer going to move forward with me in the interview process. And I reached out asking why, and they said that they would not tell me, and I begged for them to tell me. And then they called me and said that they really wanted someone who was a team player, that I was not that from what they heard. And before on the phone, they were always super friendly and kind and really enthusiastic, and their tone was a 180 and just cold and short and dismissive. And I just heard things that I was a divisive, not team player. I was lazy, and that's why they wouldn't be moving forward. And this freaked me out to lose a job because of his bad reference. And I knew, okay, I had two options and now I'm down to one. So this other church better work out. Otherwise, I'm out of a job. And this other church was in the area, and I was terrified that he was going to find out, or that someone on staff was going to find out, and that he would reach out and tell them how bad I was to work with. And that was me catastrophizing, but I lost a job opportunity because of him. So I was afraid it was going to happen again.
I mean, that is not only disheartening, but it's just sick. And I'm sorry, as someone who's led a lot of people in my career, professional career. You know, I've had people leave our organization, and I would never imagine myself not wishing that person the best on their next endeavor, because it's life. People change, things change, and we want the best for each of us to succeed. And for him to use words that aren't true to name you and to carry those words to your next potential job is evil, it's wrong, and it speaks to his character and who he is, and not who you are by any means. Those words don't belong on you. They don't belong in you. They aren't who you are. Those words reflect who he is. And if pastors are doing this and you think this is somehow spiritual discipline or building others up or hard love or tough love, you are lying to yourself and you are hurting and abusing others.
Thank you for that. I appreciate that.
It's just a lot.
It's heartbreaking that so often we hear about people leaving the presence of Christian leaders and walking away with all of these labels on themselves and like things that define who they are and their worthiness or value. And what does that say about Western evangelicalism in general, that people aren't walking away from meetings with pastors or church leaders and realizing that their worth and value is completely tied into the fact that they're made in the image of God, and that is full stop. There's no extra qualifiers added to that. That is who you are, nothing else. And the fact that the church is responsible for adding all of these extra layers of definitions onto who people are and to what makes them qualified to be in right relationship with that the community or even with God or themselves even, is some real next level BS. Like, it's really, really gross. And I'm so sorry. And I've been thinking that the whole time you've been talking. I've heard just these labels like processed Christian, lazy, divisive, emotional, all of these things that very clearly affected you and would affect anybody who's hearing people that they are being told they need to respect and are being told are spiritual leaders, putting that on you. It's detrimental to your personhood. And that's really gross. And I'm so sorry.
Thank you.
So you have this next job opportunity on the line. You have 4 weeks that you have to work. Can you walk us through the end of that and what that was like? Did you have to interact with Pastor L during that time?
Yeah. So after that second elders meeting that went so poorly, I actually had several elders reach out to me and want to sit down with me and give me a chance to be heard. Because they recognized that they did not handle that meeting well, which was really cool of them. So I had several reach out and just want to sit down and make things right. And I can remember coffee with one woman specifically, and she was just so apologetic, and it was really healing. And they all wanted one final meeting before I left to clear the air. And my husband was invited to this one, and he came, and he helped me verbalize some things, and we really said, like, hey, this is what this communicated, and this is how this made me feel. And there were a lot of, like, oh, we didn't see that, like, in the room. And there was a lot of healing and mutual understanding that I feel like happened. And they were not aware of some comment cards that were being left. They were not aware of notes being left on my desk. And they responded saying, that wasn't okay. We didn't know that was happening. And they were super shocked. And they were like, that's inappropriate. And that should never have happened. I'm sorry. And that was really interesting, because when I had brought that up to Lee, it was something that I should have taken more responsibility for, that that had happened in the first place. But the elders were like, oh, that was wrong, and were actually willing to name that. So I feel like on both sides of this conversation, I was able to apologize for how I misunderstood them on some things. They apologized to me, and it just felt super healing. And like, the elders and I closed a major chapter in that meeting. They prayed for me at the end. It was really meaningful. But Pastor L was in that meeting and was visibly angry the whole time. The rest of the room was like, open and warm and engaged and listening to me. And he was sitting with his arms crossed and a scowl on his face and just not warm at all, very cold. And he insisted in this meeting that we meet privately afterwards, and kept insisting on the basis of Matthew 18. And I said, no, I'm not comfortable meeting with you. And I ended up saying in front of the room, well, I lost a job opportunity because of what you said about me. So I don't really want to meet with you one-on-one. I don't feel comfortable. And he was like, well, I want to tell you about that. And I eventually, he just kept pushing. And I said, well, I'll meet with you if another elder can be there and if my husband can be there. And his response was, yeah, my husband's name is a pretty stable guy, so I guess that sounds good. Which I said nothing to this, but that made me so upset, because it was implying that I'm this hysterical woman. And that's something that gets put on women a lot, is, well, your husband's pretty stable. And my husband is. He's like the chillest guy ever and super steady. But if he really thought that I was unstable, why would he want to have a conversation with me at all? But the elders leave the room, and now it's me, Pastor L, my husband, and another elder who's just kind of there to be present. And most of this conversation is Pastor L talking at me about how disappointed he was. He did bring up the job interview and said, well, I told them how talented you were, but then, you know, I told them about our working relationship, and that's probably not a place you want to be if all these things are important to them. And it was just once again, like, going back to the only good thing he could ever say about me was that I was talented. There was no actual value on me as a person or leader. Just, well, the product she produced was great. She has a great voice. It doesn't really mean much. But he's talking at me and just saying how disappointed he was that our working relationship didn't work out, because he had such high hopes for me. And then he says to me that it was especially disappointing for him because he had paternal feelings towards me. And when he said that, it was like, it just knocked the wind out of me. It made everything begin to make sense and connect in my head that, oh, I'm about the same age as his daughters. He sees me like a daughter. He doesn't see me as a person leading a ministry. He doesn't take me seriously. So I just let him get everything off his chest and heard about how disappointing I was that I was lazy, divisive, and also that I was not leaving well, because I told a few people that the reason I was leaving was about the list.
Did you respond? Did your husband respond?
No, we just kind of all sat there.
Ugh, I'm sorry. And then he felt great after that, I'm sure.
Yeah, he got everything off his chest.
And did you have to continue working with him for the next couple weeks, or was that the end?
There was like one more week.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you get the other job?
And I didn't go in the office much.
Good.
I did get the other job.
Heck yeah. And how did that go? Yeah.
That was really great. It was super healing to get that job. The church that I was at decided my end date. And then this other church offering me the job made my start date without knowing the actual day after my end date at that church. So it felt like this God thing, honestly, that it lined up that perfectly.
And so you jumped right back into ministry. And did you have a different experience? You're obviously, you're still in ministry today. So what are you doing now? And how has that journey been for you?
Yeah, that job was super healing. It helped me realize that I was believing a lot of lies about myself, that I was not a hard worker, that I wasn't a team player, all of those things. And I kind of stepped into this job thinking that that was true about myself and I better prove it wrong and change. But then I quickly learned, oh, wait, I'm a really hard worker. I am a team player. I'm not divisive. I am supportive of the leadership around me. So it was really healing for me to be appreciated and seen on this church staff. And all of my bosses that I had in my time at that church were phenomenal.
And what are you doing today?
I moved across the country and now I'm still a worship pastor, but I'm also a teaching pastor. So my role has evolved a little bit and I'm really happy where I'm at.
Look at you with a whole voice that people listen to.
Crazy.
Wild. I love that you were able to continue and that that didn't just completely crush you and make it so that you weren't able to continue in ministry, because I know that that does happen to a lot of people. And I'm grateful that you're able to continue to use your gifts and to serve the church in that way. Something unique about you is that you are still in ministry and that you wanted to share your story. So I'd love to hear your why for why you wanted to share your story with us today.
Yeah, I've been listening to this podcast for a couple of years now. And when I first started listening to these stories, I kept thinking back to this experience at this first job and thinking, oh my gosh, I can really draw these parallels and see my story and these people's stories and relate. And I felt really seen and a little bit validated. But at the same time, I kept thinking that either what happened to me wasn't as serious or that I was to blame because of my immaturity as a 19 to 20 year old new leader. So I kept kind of redirecting the blame back on myself and saying, okay, well, their story is worth empathy. Their story is valid, but mine's not. It was actually my fault. And I went through a lot of therapy to kind of reprocess and open up this story and reframe it. But I can recognize mistakes I made along the way and things that I learned and then see how differently Pastor B treated me with mistakes I made as a learning leader versus how Pastor L treated me, and recognize that I deserved more grace. And even though I would handle certain things differently now, it doesn't change the fact that what happened to me was still wrong. And I think there's always going to be narratives that we deal with like that in our brains that, well, hey, you didn't handle this situation quite right, so that makes you not worthy of empathy, or that invalidates your story and what happened to you was not wrong and it actually was your fault. Or maybe even thinking, well, this person went through it for longer, or what happened to them was more serious. They didn't get out as quickly as I did. So your story doesn't deserve to be heard. But something that was really healing for me at my next job, I was sitting down with my new boss, kind of told him really lightly some of the stuff that had happened at this previous church with Pastor L. And I remember looking up at him and his face is stunned and there's tears in his eyes. And he just says, I want you to know that was spiritual abuse. I was afraid to say that because I also thought if I mentioned something like that, that I would be seen as a red flag or a problem for naming it. But there's something really powerful about when we name things as they are. It turns a light on in the darkness and gives people the space to actually accept what happened to them as it was and know that everything they went through is worthy of healing and worthy of someone hearing their story.
That was beautiful. And that same kind of light, what would you say to others who are going through similar situations to you right now?
However small your story feels to you, it's actually not that small and it matters. And there are people that want to hear and want to sit with you through that. So find those people, because it's healing to find someone who will find that solidarity with you and give you that space to heal.
How has your experience shaped how you now lead as a pastor?
I think when I usually think about how my experiences shaped me, it's like I can see my self-protectiveness and like, I don't know if I'll ever get over feeling like I have to prove myself, that I'm not this lazy, divisive person. So I'm always going to have these like self-doubts and this unhealthy need to be the opposite of what I thought I was. But I think the biggest impact this has had on how I lead and how I pastor people is that I know that if you've been in church like at all, you have a story of church hurt and possibly church abuse. And my immediate reaction is always to believe people, that what they're telling me is true, and to sit with them in their hurt. And I want to be the type of pastor and leader that shines a light in the darkness on these things and doesn't perpetuate systems of abuse that just keep getting covered up. I will never tell someone that they need to leave well. You don't owe anyone leaving a church well. I think you can leave kicking and screaming and saying what happened to you. So at any church I'm at, I'm never going to try to shut people up.
That's encouraging to hear, just in general. There are pastors out there that are not shady. So thank you for that. We have one more question that we love to ask our storytellers, in just giving them an opportunity to say what they would want to say to their former church and their former church leaders. Pastor L, is there anything you want to say to them?
Yeah, to my former church and the leaders there, genuinely, I'm thankful for my time there. I'm thankful for my first ministry job being at an egalitarian church that helped me begin my deconstruction process by considering that women were allowed to have a voice and allowed to be in pastoral leadership. So I'm genuinely thankful for that and my time there. I'm thankful for a church that did take a chance on me as a really young leader and that did support me and gave me the opportunity to be in ministry. I would not be in ministry if it wasn't for them. And I hope that you continue to elevate the leadership of women and the voices of women. Overall, I'm just grateful for my experience there.
And what would be your encouragement to churches that are egalitarian or say they value women's voices, but have predominantly like a male vision caster? What would be your encouragement for them to just be cautious of and mindful of?
Men and white men will always be the loudest voice in the room. Naturally, allowing women a seat at the table is not the same as listening to them and elevating their voices. And hiring a man who says that he believes in women, make sure that there's a track record of that that is not his wife or daughter's. A lot of men in these egalitarian spaces will say that they believe in women, but the only women they've ever platformed are related to them in some sense, and they struggle with the leadership of women who they're not related to. So that is a sign of a soft complementarian who is not truly egalitarian. So make sure the men that you are hiring truly listen to, platform, and champion women.
Words have the potential to be a refreshing wave of goodness and filled with possibility. But words can also be invisible daggers that slowly poison our safety and worth. The church should be a place where all can find words of comfort, compassion, and understanding. This is what Taylor believed when she joined the staff of her church. A talented and eager musician, Taylor knew that words had the ability to create a sacred space where all felt safe to worship. What Taylor didn't realize was that for women in certain religious spaces, there were unwritten rules for their words and presence. Blurry lines held up by men whose philosophies on ministry were centered around dismantling anything that they don't agree with. And with their words, these men inflict deep spiritual and emotional wounds. The words spoken over Taylor were evil and lies. And as the body of Christ, we owe Taylor and every other woman who has endured this type of abuse more than just our thoughts, prayers, and apologies. For Johnny Harris, I'm Jay Coyle, and this is the Bodies Behind the Bus podcast. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed here are the speaker's own and not those of this podcast. This content is presented for informational and educational purposes that constitute fair use, commentary, or criticism. While we make every effort to ensure that the information shared is accurate, we welcome any comment, suggestion, or correction of errors.